This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Melinda Penn-Cava. Spalding Gray started doing monologues 20 years ago. He's been without peer through a series of one-man shows that takes his audiences through trials and tribulations. There's Swimming to Cambodia, Gray's Anatomy, Monster in a Box, and Slippery Slope, his last one. Now, Spalding Gray has a new monologue and book, Morning, Noon, and Night, which centers on the household he's part of in Sag Harbor on Long Island. This one reflects the changes in his life since the last monologue, namely his two sons, their mother, and a stepdaughter. There's constant exposure to Tickle Me Elmo dolls and the Spice Girls, and a view of a cemetery and churches, which I can't begin to do any justice to. And thankfully, Spalding Gray is with us this hour from our New York Bureau to talk about his monologue and life beyond it. Welcome to Talk of the Nation, Spalding Gray.
Thank you.
And if you'd like to talk with Spalding Gray, our number here is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. If you send us an email at totn.npr.org, please include your first name and where it is you're writing from. Well, this is a departure from your other monologues, focusing so much on home life there?
Well, the home life is a departure from my life. I mean, it's the first. I mean, it's my first family at, I'm 58 years old. The monologue is about having the family at 56. So I'm already down the street and I'm coming around the corner with the audience. So it's a huge departure.
Yeah, I'm wondering how if you're doing a monologue where, and you're still in this family, of course, right now, mm-hmm. and in your past monologues, it's been about something that happened, and you were talking about this thing that might have happened a few years ago. Mm-hmm. But here you are continuing to live in this family with your sons and Kathy and your stepdaughter. And
this is a very odd, almost skitsy experience in which I have to have my notebook in front of me when I'm performing so that I remember the ages of the children in the monologue. That Forrest is in he's five and he's in kindergarten. He's now seven in second grade. He's an entirely different human being. And what I find wonderful is being able to celebrate them at that particular day in 1997 in the monologue. So it's like a family album, and then come back and experience the changes since then. I really like the dialectic between the two.
Mm-hmm. How real is this idea that, you know, the story of your domestic life could possibly overtake life itself? I mean, that the story could be better, it sounds?
Yeah, I've always said that I would rather tell a life than live a life, but I have to live a life in order to tell one. Mm-hmm. The telling, like any art, is always safer, and you're in much more control, and you really edit and shape, and you're in charge of it, and you have a ball with it. And the living is completely chaotic, and everyone else around you is in control. So what I like at times is to be out on the road performing my monologue and to call home and talk with Kathy and hear the children in the background, talk with them one at a time and say, oh, it's so wonderful to have that lovely family over there in Sag Harbor while I'm in this five-star hotel in Colorado doing this monologue about them channel surfing, you know.
1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK is our number. We're talking today with Spalding Gray, and if you'd like to talk with him, give us a call. Again, the number is 1-800-989-8255. I was wondering if you could give us a sample of some of this monologue.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'd be glad to. I'll jump right in. I'm taking Forrest downtown to rent a video. We don't have a television in our home in Sag Harbor, but we do have a VCR. And so I've picked him up at kindergarten, and he's going to ride his bike downtown beside me with a little trainer wheels. And I say it's an afternoon project because the video store is right at the bottom of the street, but he cannot ask questions and ride at the same time. So he's constantly braking and stopping. And we stop outside the Five and Dime, the Ben Franklin Five and Dime, which really hasn't changed since 1922. Forrest looks in the window. I assume he wants something. And then I say to him, did you want to go in there, sweetie? Oh, no, I'm fine. Where does he get that little adult cocktail hour response, like, may I fish in your drink? No, I'm fine. He's not a grand acquisitor. That's one of the things I love about Forrest. I fell in love with Forrest when I saw him with his balloons at 1.5. He would get very attached to them, then let them go up into the sky and watch them with a smile. I fell in love with him again that first time he was making cupcakes. We were making cupcakes for the whole family, and his sister was away for a month, and he insisted on making one for his sister, Marissa, and kept it till September when she came back. I fell in love with him again that first Halloween, when and we were trick-or-treating, and he was downtown, and we went uptown to the big houses, and he said, I want to go home because I've had enough candy. And when he got home, he started giving away our candy. When we ran out of candy, he gave away his, and when the kids no longer came to the door, he chased them down the street, giving away his candy. Now, past the Five and Dime, past the IGA, he turns to me and says, Dad, could I tell you something? How come deer poops are so small? Because, Dad, really, a deer is as big as a horse, and the poop is the size of a rabbit's. Well, Forrest, I'm going to look that up when I get home. I'm glad I bought those Encyclopedia Britannica from that traveling salesman for a reason. Dad, could I tell you something? Why can't we feel the earth spinning? That's another good one, Forrest. I'm going to look that up as soon as we get back, because I'm sure it is spinning. Dad, one more thing, sweetie. What is it? Dad, how to fly. Celebrate? How do flies celebrate? And then I come to it. I'd say basically, Forrest, by flying from one pile of poop to another. And we both laugh and go into the video store.
What did you rent?
Oh, that goes on and on and on. He goes in, he rents James and the Giant Peach. He tells me to rent the Nutty Professor because he's already seen it with his mom and sister, right? Mm-hmm. So I go to rent the Nutty Professor, and the woman in the video store says, not for the little boy, if that's your son. I said, oh, he's already seen it. He's recommending it to me. And that's when I say, ooh, we may not be long for this town. We're being censored in the video store. And it goes on and on and on for an hour and a half, nonstop.
Now, you haven't performed this in Sag Harbor.
I haven't, and I was asked to. There's a lovely theater out there, the Bay Street Theater, and it really, I have really kept away from that. I want the children to be greater human beings than lesser celebrities first. Mm-hmm. And it's just better for me to... I did perform at East Hampton. That was pretty close.
Mm-hmm. But the idea... How about the idea of as they grow up, too? That, you know, Dad's talking about me when I'm a teenager, and I guess Marissa's is a teenager now.
Marissa is 13, and she's already gotten a little response at the private school she goes out to there. I think her French teacher took her on. I was told about crying out in my sailboat when it tipped, help, help, I don't want to die a virgin. Help, Coast Guard, I don't want to die a virgin. So he picked that line out as being rather precocious, but... some part of her being the drama queen that she is, she enjoys that. But I want to point out that I don't think I'm going to be doing the ongoing Ozzie and Harriet soap opera of Spalding Gray. So I think this monologue will have a life of a couple more years and then cool down. And hopefully I'll be on to something else that won't involve turning the children into characters.
1-800-989-8255. 1-800-989-TALK is our number. We're talking today with Spalding Gray. If you have a question for him, we're having a dialogue this hour. The number is 1-800-989-8255. We'll go to Honolulu. Mike is there. Hi there, Mike.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Okay, how are you?
I wanted to ask Spalding if you'd comment on the media mania going on about the millennium ending this year instead of next year. So many columnists and talk show hosts keep making reference to, you know, that the millennium's ending in 7 days or a month when it's not till next year.
Wow. Thanks for telling me about it all the way from Honolulu. I don't even think about the millennium. I am so immersed in this small town consciousness living in Eastern Long Island. I'm mainly concerned with the nuclear power plant in Waterford, Connecticut that we're trying to shut down, and we're afraid of being around it come the millennium. So we're going to an island off the coast of Maine.
Are you?
How's the weather there in Honolulu?
It's beautiful here.
I'll bet.
It never changes. 80 degrees all the time.
I don't know if I'd like that.
You don't like
but
warm weather?
I wish I could help you out.
You know your Y2K there with the nuclear power plant. I mean, mm-hmm. It's a similar type of media madness where I'm just astounded that writers don't realize that, you know, 2001 means year one in the 21st
century. Well, see, I fail seventh
grade
math.
2020 refers to 20, you know, centuries, so the 20th century doesn't end till next year.
Right.
I'm starting to understand you, but I did fail seventh grade math, and numbers are a total... I don't relate to them. Whenever my son Forrest starts counting from 1 to 100, I say, stop. I can't. I have no associations from numbers.
Now, this fear about the nuclear plant, you're downwind of it just across mm-hmm. Long Island Sound, right?
We're 15 miles downwind, and the NRC is saying that it's safe to be 10 miles. So there's no evacuation plan for Eastern Long Island. And if you've ever been out there, the Long Island Expressway is, what a joke.
So you just have to be hoping the wind isn't any more than 5 miles an hour from the north that day.
Or we have to move out. We're fighting it. I'm on the board for STAR, which is Stand Up for Truth About Radiation, which Helen Caldicott helped get started out there. And we're Trying.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We'll go to Jeff, who's in Huntington Woods, Michigan. Hi there, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, how are you doing?
Not too bad. I've seen you many a time, Spalding, when you've come to Ann Arbor.
Oh, yeah. It's a great theater there.
And it's always a pleasure seeing you. I was just curious how you got involved with the book In Search of the Monkey Girl.
Yes, that book. A friend of mine who was a fan, who used to come to my monologues, he would go around photographing freaks and carnivals and sideshows, and he felt he couldn't write the text for the photographs. And it's a beautiful book, Aperture Coffee Table book. And Randy Levinson, who was doing the photographs, asked me to do the text and to travel with him to a sideshow, you know, with all of these, Priscilla the monkey girl and Emmett the alligator man, and it was down in Nashville, Tennessee. And as soon as I got down there with him in his truck, we were sleeping in the back of his truck, I went right across the street and called Greyhound to see how much it would be to get back. I was totally freaked out by it. And this was good. I mean, it was good. It threw me into the thick of it. He felt he couldn't write his own text because he'd studied Latin in high school, and he felt that destroyed his ability to write. So I was hired as a partner to go down with him, and it turned out to be a really, really good experience for me. Really, you know, it was fun.
I think you did a great job on it. I mean, it just is a great book.
Thank you. So. It is lovely. I think it is.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for your call, Jeff. We'll go to Neil, who's in Cleveland. Hi there, Neil.
Hi. Good to be talking to you both. Spalding, I'm one of the people that actually first met you back during the performance group days in New York.
Uh-huh.
And I thought your performance as Haas in Tooth of Crime is one of the great performances of the 20th century in theater.
Oh, thanks for reminding me.
Sure. And I just wondered how you went about making the transition from that kind of theater to doing the kind of performance artwork that you're doing now.
Well, first of all, I don't think of myself as a performance artist, but I think of myself as an actor who's playing myself and was really trained in traditional acting. And it's interesting you should talk about Sam Shepard's Tooth of Crime, because that was one of the seeds in which I began to move into my own space, because Richard Schechner had been directing it. And he asked me at one point just to stand very still and look at the audience. They were all surrounding. There were no fixed seating. It was environmental. And just look them into the eyes and drop my character. And it was the first time in the theater that he requested as a director that I get back to myself or a neutral place. And discovering being in that neutral place in front of that audience, I thought, well, what if I had something to say other than Sam Shepard's lines at this point? What would they be? And that's where the writer and the need for that crept in. And then I began to evolve the Worcester group out of the performance group with Elizabeth LeCompte. And they were my first real... I mean, they really encouraged me to go ahead and do this direct address to the audience. And I started working with the Worcester Group, doing a series of collaborative pieces, somewhat about my own life and somewhat about the vision of the group collectively. And once I split from the group in 1979, I didn't know what I was going to do next, and I realized what I was doing in the group was direct address to the audience and loved it. And I put a little table in the performing garage in 1979 in September and sat down with a little notebook with an outline and did my first monologue, Sex and Death to the Age 14, mm-hmm. in which I tried to remember everything that happened around that topic. And I was having public memory. I would tape record it, and each night the memories would get a little longer. So it went from 40 minutes to 50 to 60 to an hour and 20 minutes. And this led to more. It opened up that associative memory muscle, and that just led to 18 more monologues.
Well, Neil, thanks for your call, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation. I'm Melinda Pencava. Our guest this hour is performer Spalding Gray, monologuist and actor. If you have a question, give us a call. Our number's 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. We have to take a short break right now, but when we come back, we'll get to more of your calls. You can also send us an email at totn@npr.org, and please let us know your first name and where it is you're writing from. Or if you care to send us a letter, it's Talk of the Nation Letters, 635 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20001. At 21 minutes past the hour, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation. I'm Melinda Pencava, and today we're talking with writer, actor, and monologuist Spalding Gray about his latest monologue of his life. This one's called Morning, Noon, and Night. If you'd like to join us, our number's 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Spalding Gray, I wonder, this latest monologue includes your children, and I wonder if you think that they might go into the business and someday they'll be doing monologues about Dad.
I don't think that. First of all, Forrest is way too, right now he's very reflexive and very quiet. Theo might, though. Theo's probably going to be an actor. He's very active and out there. But, hey, that would be a very unexpected thing. I don't think about it, but now you got me thinking about it.
Yeah. You know, at one point in your monologue, this most recent one, Morning, Noon, and Night, it's morning, you're flipping through the paper and obsessing about things that you're finding in the Times,
I'm trying to objectify my anxiety, I say, by trying to find disastrous stories in the Science Times, yeah.
Right, and one of them's like impotence from bike riding
and
unpredictable asteroids. I'm curious about your take on some stories that are given more play. We already had a call asking about the millennium, but some other issues that, you know, have come up in the news lately. I'm just curious on your take about, say, this idea of kids and media, like how much TV time kids are watching every day.
What is the new report on that? I haven't heard it.
Well, saying it was the equivalent of a work week that kids are spending with media, and it's about 19 hours a week are watching television of that. And then there's computers and there's print as well,
TV
is the bulk of it.
Well, that's why we've kept it out of the house, actually. And I'm so glad that we've been able to, and the children are not trying to overthrow that anymore. And so in our case, and I really can only speak from where I'm at with my family and not in America in general, although my main problem with contemporary culture is, for me, is virtual mediation. I think that my being out on the road when I'm doing my live show, that's now a very radical event because I'm appearing in person. I mean, I'm the live figure, you see. Mm-hmm. And that, I feel like a Johnny Appleseed with talking about, hey, being here with prana and presence. And what is most discouraging for me, what I see is the virtual reality and the kids are indoors watching an image. Mm-hmm. Our kids watch videos only on weekends, and that's that. It's limited to that. The rest of the time, they are in they're playing amongst themselves, or they're doing homework, or they're drawing, or they're in front of the fire, or they're doing something physical. But it's great.
How about the presidential race? A year off now. Any thoughts on what you're seeing happening so far?
Oh, the money issue is very discouraging. I have fears about the Republicans and money ruling, and I fear Bush. And
for what reason?
I think that I don't relate to money as a source of power. It strikes me as being a rather empty thing that he is known. I think I know him best for how much money he's raised. And that's a very odd thing to be measuring a candidate by that I don't ever remember happening before. So I'm a little trembly around that, and I suppose I'm a Democrat. I vote Democratic, and that was a long way coming. I didn't vote until I was about 39 years old.
Really? For what reason?
Yeah.
Why put it off so long?
I wasn't interested. I was never interested in voting for anyone. And I was doing a piece called Interviewing the Audience, and I was interviewing a woman up on stage who was doing voter registration. And she signed me up and said, you've got to vote this year. And I voted for Ferraro and
Mondale? Was that the year?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that was my first year of voting. Mm-hmm. And I felt that I had helped them win, which I didn't, by pulling that lever. It was a very powerful and exciting time.
We're going to go to Greg in Santa Rosa, California now. Hi there, Greg.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay, how are you?
I am good.
Did you have a question for Spalding Gray?
Yeah, I do. I saw you when you were doing the slippery slope up here in Santa Rosa. Absolutely loved it.
Uh-huh.
I'm a professional storyteller, and out in the audience we started there were a number of other storytellers and whatnot. We got into a discussion, and one person was saying, God, he's the best storyteller I've ever heard. And then several other people were saying, well, I don't really think of him as a storyteller. I think it's more like theater. And I was wondering if you had ever thought about that or been asked anything about that, the difference between monologue and traditional storytelling.
Yeah, I have been, and I do think about it. And I think that what I am doing certainly is a form of storytelling, but I like to think of it as theater of the mind in the sense that I grew up with radio and love radio and love being on it right now because my imagination was stimulated to the point that I created my own Ozzie and Harriet house, and it was a conglomeration of my imagination and a friend's house down the street. And I didn't know how much I loved that until it was stolen from me and literalized by television, and I had to look at that literal image of Ozzie and Harriet and Rick and David, which ultimately wasn't as interesting. So I think that I've always stayed with that, and I hope that the audience, either they're old enough to realize that process or young enough to discover it for themselves, that they're active in it. It's a dialogue. They're very active. They have to color it with their imaginations. So within that, I mean, it is storytelling, but when I went to the Storytelling Festival down in Jonesboro, Tennessee, at the time, there was no one doing the autobiographic mode. I was like this urban autobiographic storyteller. And the others were doing stories that were folktales that were handed down, like Princess and the Pea. And I think there's less of a movement of that now and more of a movement of getting more personal with stories. And I like seeing that. I do workshops occasionally at Esalen Institute in Big Sur. And I've had some people come out of those workshops that have gone out and continued to do their stories in clubs and venues of storytelling.
Well, Greg, thanks for your call.
You bet.
You know, in your monologue, you made an aside there about a neighbor who was telling jokes, and you made this aside mm-hmm. that you don't really, you're almost uncomfortable, I think, with telling them as much as listening to them.
Yeah, I've never been a fan of jokes or stand-up. I think of myself as a humorist. I never laugh, so I'm very happy, or I rarely laugh. The children make me laugh occasionally, but when my audience is laughing, they're laughing for me. It completes a relationship there, and the laughter is not based around setup and delivered jokes, but based around more a sliding humor, which is juxtaposing the sad, the poignant, and the funny, all like life. It's reflecting life. So when someone's doing a well-contrived joke and trying to spell it out for me, I'm wondering why I'm only laughing at the end. We should be laughing throughout the whole joke, you understand? Uh-huh. And that's how I like my stories. I was doing interviewing the audience in Washington, D.C. at the Kennedy Center, and I was interviewing a young man from Iceland, and he lived in Washington, but he had moved from Iceland to Washington. I think he was 15 years old. And I said, do you know any good jokes? I was just asking him questions. And he said, yeah, I know some. I said, well, tell it in Icelandic. And the whole audience was laughing for the entire joke. There was no punchline. Just to hear the joke told in Icelandic was one of the funniest things I've ever heard. It was just delightful.
All right. We go to Lori, who's in Seattle now. Hi, Lori.
Hi there. Hey, Spalding. I met you and Kathy doing massage here last spring, I was wondering how much your monologue has changed since you've been taking it around the country.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, you'd have to see it and then tell me, because I'm always in it, and I know it's evolving, but I'm always tuning it, and there's no time that, even now at Lincoln Center, where I'm playing at the Vivian Beaumont Theater on Mondays and Sundays, I tape record them and occasionally listen back, and I'm always... It's like a number painting that you're continually filling in and refining. So there's no closure on it. And that's why the book is one thing and movies of the monologues are one thing. But ultimately, the monologue, when it is continue to be played, it is never finished. And that I love. That keeps it alive.
Alive and growing.
Mm-hmm.
I also want you to know that I promise never to call my son Sport or Buddy. And that was one of the favorite parts of the monologue.
Great.
Thank you for that.
Thanks. Yeah.
What's wrong with calling your son's Sport or Buddy?
Oh, we should have asked Lori when we had her on the line. I don't know. Nothing's wrong with it. I'm not here to judge.
Okay. Patrick's in St. Augustine, Georgia, I believe. Hi there, Patrick.
Hi. Hi. Hello, Spalding. Unlike everyone else, I haven't met you. I'd love to someday. I got so much from your Swimming to Cambodia monologue. As a Vietnam vet, I feel like that you did a lot in that monologue to somehow reconcile some of the madness, in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was quite a contribution.
Good.
Not to mention hysterically funny. I can't think of your name without thinking of Spoldingman.
Ivan, yeah. Ivan, second time.
My question actually was somewhat answered by the last caller, which was I wanted to know how much the monologue does evolve or how spontaneous and improvisational it is on a given night and how much you allow the the room to tell you what, you know, what...
Oh, that well, part. That's a good question.
Yeah, thank you.
First of all, the audience is my wall, my editor, my sounding board, and the audience is given me the gift of letting me evolve the monologue with them. So I always thank them and say, this is a work in progress. When I begin, I sit down with an outline and speak it to the audience for the first time. There's no memorization. I am... shall we call it improvising? Yes, but when people do improvisational theater, mainly what they're trying to do is to keep going out and associating as far as they can and bring in contemporary themes and really spin. I start with a story that's set in a particular time, improvise it, and then try to draw it in. Let it set itself. So it's all kind of like bushwhacking. An actor that's memorizing lines has to pretend that they haven't memorized that line to make it fresh. So they, you know, they're pretending that something hasn't happened that really has. I'm not pretending. I never memorized the line. So the actor that memorizes the line is really on a track. I'm bushwhacking up or down the same mountain in a different way every night. And eventually I start to see the trail.
It becomes
organic. Yeah. Well, it's the only way I know how to work. And so what it finally does is it gets refined and it gets rather set. So there's minutia of changes now in the monologue, but there still are those. It's still breathing.
Yeah, it's still growing. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for your call, Patrick.
Right.
Let's see. Dan is in Berkeley. Hi there.
Hello.
Dan.
Hi. Spalding, I have I guess this is sort of a personal question and also kind of an existential one. I'm a young man, an artist, and I'm going to be a father soon, I think. And I'm just wondering how you were personally able to reconcile that big responsibility with continuing your work as an artist and growing as an artist.
Because I didn't do it when I was young.
Yeah, okay.
That's a tough one. I mean, I wish you well with it, and I go for it. I didn't think I would ever have a family or children. They were both glorious accidents, all three of my stepdaughter and my two sons. And it came very late in life, and it came at the right time. So I'm not as ambitious with my work. I have found a completion in it. I've done 20 years of monologues. I've done 18 of them. If they stop now at morning, noon, and night, I'm perfectly able, I think, to devote and center myself around my family right now. And I have that to go to, and that's good for me.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Dan. What would you do if you didn't do monologues? I understand the way you work is you're doing the monologue right now, so you're not gathering material. Is that right?
That's right. I call my monologue like a transitional object. Once I have a monologue up and running, I'm much freer just to live my life because I'm not processing all the time and looking for material or doing an inner commentary. So it's my transitional object into reality. I go, oh, now I can just live my life, be with the family, and experience things without storing it like a little anal squirrel in my little notebook. Then if the monologue starts to run for 2 or 3 years, that creator starts to come in, and I start looking around, and I start telling stories about my life to friends and seeing where they fit into the fabric, and I choose, well, what is the next issue about? You know, is it about the nuclear power plant? Is it about working in a hospice for the dying? Whatever is happening in the community around my life begins to be a centrifugal force in the new story.
Okay. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Patrick's in Cleveland. Hi there, Patrick.
Yes, hello.
Oh, I'm coming to Cleveland, yeah.
Patrick? I wanted to tell Spalding that I really appreciate listening to his monologues and really like the pace at which he moves the dialogue, and I was wondering if he has trouble...
The monologue, yeah.
Spalding, if you have trouble listening to other people speak, and if you find your mind racing ahead of them as they speak.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question, and what I do to try to get off of the really rapid-fire monologue and listen to people as I do this piece called Interviewing the Audience, which I've done since 1980. And in the theater, I hang out in the lobby, and I just intuitively go to people of different ages and sexes to try. So if I ask you to come up tonight, will you come up and talk with me? Well, they go, we're talking about what? About anything. You know, it is not a non-agenda thing. Whatever comes up, we'll go with it. And that is all about listening. And it taught me to be a good listener, and also led me to realize that I also can do that well. I'm a very strong Gemini. I have those two sides of the obsessive rapper and then the very quiet listener. am coming to Cleveland, by the way, in February with Morning, Noon, and Night, so it's one show. I'm sorry I don't know the date, but I hope you can come.
Oh, great. Actually, I saw it in Chicago.
Oh, good.
I'm on my way driving now.
Oh, you are?
Show. Yeah.
Oh, great.
Thank you very much.
How virtual, how modern, how, wow. Great cell phones.
Thanks for your call, Patrick.
Bye.
How about this idea of, how about listening in private conversations as well? Do you find that you listen more? Say you're in a social setting among a lot of people you may not know. Do you find that you're listening
more?
Yeah,
I do, because I do listen, because particularly if I'm in a place where I'm trying to focus on gathering material. Because, people often invite me to parties or out on their boats, in the case of Sag Harbor, thinking I am going to be Robin Williams or some version of it, where I cannot stop rapping and entertaining, and it's just the opposite, because how else do I create if I'm not absorbing what's around me? So there is that, and also I'm told by people that observe that I listen well to my children, and I think that's true. I'm very interested in and enthralled by children's minds, and particularly my two sons, the way that they think and see the world, and I love, that's very refreshing. I've said I don't miss the art scene of New York City because I have my new art eyes. Theirs, the way they see the world, refreshes my vision of the world.
And they also give you great material, don't they?
Well, they have. I don't want to keep soaking them for that. But it's
but
invaluable.
Why not?
I mean, you're right. Just the other day, Forrest, who's just, he's seven now, and he's been too quiet, in my opinion, because he's as his teacher said in the parent-teachers meeting, he's probably reached the point where he likes to keep some of his thoughts to himself. And I went, oh, really? I didn't know that was a place that we reach. I haven't got there. But he looked over at me. We're in the loft. I have a loft in New York City in the house in Sag Harbor. And he said, Dad, I was saying, you know, Forrest, everything has an opposite. And he just looked across the loft and said, what's the opposite of that piano? And I thought about that for a week. And I finally came up with the answer. I said, the opposite of the piano in the loft is the one that we don't have in the house in Sag Harbor. So he sets me off a lot.
And did he accept that now at the age of seven as an answer?
He nodded. He liked it. Yep.
Okay. We're going to go to Gail in Boston right now. Hi, Gail.
Oh, hi. I had a question for Spalding.
Uh-huh.
I just wanted to let him know that I really enjoyed seeing him in movies on film, and my question is, why don't we see more of him on film?
I keep asking that question to my manager all the time, and I'm ready to do, it's been a long time since I've done a film, and I now have a new manager who is starting to push me into films, so I hope that you'll see me soon.
Well, thanks for your call, Gail, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation. I'm Melinda Pencava. We have to take a short break right now, but when we come back, we'll keep talking with our guest, Spalding Gray, about his latest work, his latest monologue, Morning, Noon, and Night, and we'll get to more of your calls, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. That email address is TOTN@npr.org. At 40 minutes past the hour, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation. I'm Melinda Pencava. At this time tomorrow, tune in for a look at one of America's best-known artists, Norman Rockwell. There's a major retrospective of his work touring the country, and it's causing some in the art world to rethink their view of the man called the painter of the American scene. Norman Rockwell is a Talk of the Nation tomorrow at this time. Today, we're talking with monologuist Spalding Gray, who has a new monologue out. It's his 18th in 20 years. This one's called Morning, Noon, and Night, and if you'd like to join us, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Well, Spalding Gray, can you give us another bit of this monologue that you are touring with now?
Yeah, I'd love to do the closing section, which I love. And it's we're putting the children to bed in the attic there. Forrest and Mercer up in the attic. Theo's already asleep, and I come up, and Kathy has finished reading to Forrest, and she goes over to kiss Marissa goodnight at the far end of the attic. I turn out the nightlight next to Forrest, and I look up, and I am amazed to see through the skylight. We can see the stars. It's a clear October night, a moonless October night, and there are no shopping malls or plazas around to wipe the sky out. And Forrest goes, Dad, look at the stars. And I say, yeah, aren't they incredible? And he says, Dad, Can I tell you something? You see the stars? I said, yeah. What's beyond them, Dad? Forrest, we don't really know that, honey. No, don't, Dad. See this, Taurus? Dad, what's on the other side of them? Forrest, that's a mystery here on Earth that we haven't solved yet, sweetie. No, Dad. You see the stars? Forrest, look at Daddy, look at me, and tell me what I've been telling you about the stars. And he looks up at me and says, shitty, caca, pee-bone, penis breath. And I kiss him goodnight, and I go to leave, and he stops me and says, Dad, I am so glad you met Mom, or I would have been stuck inside a sperm forever. And I go to the far end of the attic, and I kiss Marissa goodnight. She's lying there alternating between teen people and wives of Henry VIII. And I meet Kathy at the top of the attic stairs, and we go down and collapse into bed. Kathy's going to read herself to sleep. I kiss her and roll over in darkness. I don't want to read or watch a video. It's 10:15, and I am wasted, and I haven't even gone to work. How do they do it? How do people raise family and work at the same time? I pray for the single mothers, I think, as I lie there in the dark thinking, you know, but really, I start again all tomorrow. We start again the whole thing over. But it hasn't been a bad day, really. You should give thanks. I mean, think of all that could go wrong. And I begin to. Lying there in the darkness, I begin to think of the Millstone reactor melting down in Waterford, rogue asteroids, the Islamic Jihad, my bicycle seat, pesticides in the water, Long Island cancer cluster, childhood leukemia, chronic fatigue syndrome. What if Kathy got chronic fatigue syndrome? What would I ever do? And all of these images begin to spin around and around like a wheel, like a Ferris wheel, like a Tibetan wheel of living and dying. They're making me nauseous, like the cover of Time and Newsweek, and I have to reach through that wheel and grab a story to save me, a memory, and I'm suddenly back at the funeral of Forrest's great-grandmother, and I'm remembering that event. I think because that funeral was so important to our family, the unspoken recognition of death united the family in a way that no Christmas or New Year's ever could. And in that church, I am sitting now beside Forrest, the casket is there, and the priest is carrying on saying, do not grieve and mourn for Anne today, but celebrate her passing. And Forrest goes, Dad, I gotta pee so bad. I said, so do I, honey. Let's get out of here. We go back into the men's room, and damn it all, if they aren't broadcasting that funeral in the men's room, saying, Anne, you pass from this troubled world into the glorious light. And we are having a pee contest to see who can finish first. Of course, Forrest always wins because his bladder is smaller. And all of a sudden, he looks over at me and takes me back and goes, oh, wow. Dad, look at your penis. And I'm a little confused, and I say, oh, yeah, it's 56 years old, and it's really been around. And Forrest goes, wow, 56 years old, and it's not even a person. And I laugh so hard and feel so much love for this child at that moment that I can't let the love in. It's too painful. And instead of letting it in, I see another epitaph from that historic cemetery that reads, it's a fearful thing to love what death can touch. And I think hell for me would be suddenly falling dead on this men's room floor and some conscious part of me floating up is held by the gravity of love I feel for my son, but cannot get back to touch him and cannot die either. That would be hell. And thinking of this now, I grab Forrest and hold him in my arms. And I say, oh, Forrest, child, light of my life, even now as I'm holding you, I can feel time stealing you away.
Spalding Gray from his monologue, the ending of his monologue, Morning, Noon, and Night. It's his latest monologue, and it's being performed these days. And there's a book to go along with it as well, is that right?
Yeah, it's a written version of it, which I did separately from the orally evolved version. So Frost, Strauss, and Giroux has published it, and it's out there in the bookstores.
All right. And if you'd like to join us, our number's 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. John is in Bend, Oregon. Hi, John.
Hi, guys. Spalding, I just wanted to say that every time I've watched you, it's been very cathartic. I watched Monster in the Bach last night.
The video's good.
Mm-hmm. And I actually work in a video store, and I'm very happy that the book has your copies, because the other place didn't, and I always held it against them.
Right.
I wanted to ask you if lately, because I was a theater major myself, if you've had any unifying accidents as of late. You talked unifying, about the monster in the box.
Did you say unifying accidents or perfect moments? I'm wondering where you got unifying accidents from. That's a different interpretation of what I refer to as the perfect moment.
Okay.
A unifying accident is an interesting concept, though I never thought about that. You know, I have a lot with the children, and most of all, I've taken up downhill skiing, and it's been very important for me because when I did a monologue, you know, about taking up downhill skiing at 52 years old called It's a Slippery Slope, and once I finished that monologue, I was under the fearful impression that once I finished using skiing as material, I'd no longer be interested in it because it would be a private event. And I've been able to maintain this private event without talking about it, so I'm not going to talk about it now. But the one thing I will say is that I have never had so many unifying accidents, if we want to call them that, or perfect moments, than flying down the ski slope with Forrest now, who's skiing very well, and Theo's just beginning, and Kathy, who's a regular meditative skier, and she stays well behind us. But that is something I really look forward to doing every year.
And just so you know, I actually did hear that monologue on Talk of the Nation, and it helped me get over my own fear of skiing.
Oh, really?
Thank you, guys.
Oh, great.
The show.
Great, thanks.
Well, thanks for your call, John. And we'll go to Brian, who's in Braintree, Mass. Hi there, Brian.
Hi. I'm Melinda Spaulding. It's a pleasure to be able to talk to both of you.
Hi.
Spaulding, I've had the opportunity to see you a number of times in Boston and Cambridge, and last time in a beautiful setting at the Dennis Playhouse in Cape Cod.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Where we saw a Slippery Slope. And
yeah.
My wife and I refer often to your monologues, especially swimming to Cambodia whenever we go into the deep water.
Right.
So you've become part of our dialogue.
How
but
nice.
A quick question about Slippery Slope. That evening, we turned to each other at the end of the performance and said to each other, as always, wow, what a great performance, what a wonderful piece of writing, thought-provoking. And then we said, but I don't know if I like the person Spalding Gray anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering what it was like to make yourself that vulnerable.
What it was just growing up, you know, and showing my shadow to the audience and turning the audience into no longer the loving mother in which the perpetual child is playing and asking for them to laugh and accept me unconditionally. And so that was a watershed monologue for me because it led into Morning, Noon, and Night, but it allowed me to, it was a tough one to do. I was in therapy for a while airing what I felt could be public and what had to be private because there was so much going on at that time.
And you held stuff back because that was a very...
I did. There's lots of stuff on the... I mean, when people say, how can you put your whole life on stage? I say, well, I'm 58 and the monologue's an hour and a half. So we got some stuff. There's nothing I haven't spoken to someone that I'm conscious of. I mean, I don't have any secrets that way, but it's often not the audience. And it often is, but It's a Slippery Slope was a watershed monologue in the sense of me that I got my first hate mail from women in this case, and I wasn't surprised, and I expected that when I was playing it at Lincoln Center. I always used to open my fan mail before I'd go on, and so I was not ready to open a letter that could be that angry and put me in. And I had to grow up and say, that is also me. I like Walt Whitman, I am filled with contradictions.
Well, this audience member enjoyed meeting the more complete person, so thank you.
Good, thanks.
Thanks for your call, Brian. Do you still open mail like that before a performance, or did you get around it by saying, okay, I'm going to wait till after the show because it could go either way here?
Yeah, well, no, I do open it for Morning, Noon, and Night. I really, I have been.
Mm-hmm. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Go to Wellesley, Mass. Tom is there. Hi, Tom. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, Melinda. Hi, Mr. Gray. Thanks
Hi.
For taking my call. It's an honor to talk to you. I admire your work tremendously. It occurs to me, as an avid listener of public radio, that Garrison Keillor is in many ways very similar you and what he does, and in many ways very different. I admire both of you very much. I was wondering if you would venture a few comments about Mr. Keillor and how you're either like him or different from him.
I think I offended Garrison Keillor early on, or not so early on, when I wrote a review of his book for the New York Times Book Review, the book Leaving Home.
Mm-hmm.
And I opened that review by telling a story about Renee, who I lived with at the time, Shafransky, who was not a fan of Garrison's. I would turn on the radio because I was always curious to hear his monologues. And she said, if you don't turn that off, I'm going to hurl it out the window. So I opened the review with that. And also talked about how I liked his prologue in the book more than I liked the stories because I was really interested in who he was. I'm a real fiend for autobiography. And Garrison has an excellent mask. And it's getting better. And I do listen to his monologues. But we have no idea who. I think there's a large gap, a discrepancy between him as writer and performer of his writings and who he is in his private life. And rightly, there should be. He's made that choice. I work in a different way. I close up the gaps. I'm much closer to my life in my work. But the thing that I have liked about Garrison's work over time, and I do follow it, as I'm sure he doesn't pay attention to mine in any way, I do follow his. And I think that more of the shadow has come into his stories. There are darker sides to them. And I used to think of him as the Arthur Godfrey of America, you know, just putting America at ease and making it sweet and fun and denying the shadow, even though he comes from a very dark, cold place. And I think his stuff is more complex now, and I like it.
That's fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call, Tom. We'll go to Joyce, who's in Berkeley. Hi, Joyce.
Hi. So nice to hear you on the radio.
Good.
I was very moved by the piece you just read, and being a mother of a 9-year-old all through her life so far, I've wanted to capture her little snippets, and I never see. I mean, I'm doing 10 things, and she says, mm-hmm. "Perfect."
Uh-huh.
How do you have time to, or when do?
Well,
I know it's your job, but still, how do you remember these perfect things they say?
I say them over and over in my head, like a litany, until I could get to a piece of paper, and I'm grabbing scrap paper everywhere, and then the scrap paper piles up, and then I enter it in a journal, and I have to say, morning, noon, and night would have been a depleted work had I not had that list of gems that Forrest would come up with that I would have forgotten, really.
Yeah.
So I actually say it like a litany in my head, like a little outline that I make until I can get it down and memorize it.
And is that a practice you've developed?
It is a practice I've developed, but also Kathy is a very good hands-on mother, so I get time to be babbling the list to myself while she takes over, you see.
There you go.
So, you know, it really, you know, we work well together, really.
I wonder if you found yourself doing that before you had kids and there would be things that other people said. And
mm-hmm.
it's just a matter of knowing what a moment is.
Exactly. You know, knowing what a moment is, that's a good point. And I think that that's one of my intuitive arts, is recognizing that good story or that moment. And often after I'm working in the morning or writing or reading, I'll go for my 6-mile bike ride outside Sag Harbor. And I will start getting real busy in my head and starting to have insights about what I'm thinking about. And as I'm writing, I will say like 4 or 5 words that are really an outline. And all I have to do when I get back is to recollect and remember those 4 words, and I will have the stories for each of those words.
Well, thanks for your call, Joyce, and thanks to everybody who called today. And thanks especially to our guest, writer, actor, and monologuist Spalding Gray, who's created 18 monologues, including the Obie Award-winning Swimming to Cambodia. His latest work is called Morning, Noon, and Night. He's touring on that right now. Spalding Gray joined us from our New York bureau. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much, Melinda. Thank you.
In Washington, I'm Melinda Pencava, NPR News.
This program is a production of National Public Radio. The views expressed are not necessarily those of NPR, the underwriters, or this broadcast station. NPR is solely responsible for this program. Tapes and transcripts of Talk of the Nation are available. Call anytime, toll-free, 1-877-NPR-TEXT. That's 1-877-NPR-TEXT.